What we found in the data is that about 50% of states that withdraw from an international organization return to the same organization later on. Exit is oftentimes used as a strategy to try to negotiate institutional change, either at the international level or at the domestic level.
Welcome to Multilateralism Unpacked, the podcast of the United Nations University Center for Policy Research. I'm David Passarelli, and I'm the director of UNUCPR. And I'm joined today by Professor Inken von Borzakowski to discuss her recent book with co-author Professor Felicity Vabulas, entitled Exit from International Organizations, published by Cambridge University Press last year and awarded the Chadwick Ulger Prize. This year, the Chadwick Ulger Prize recognizes the best book on international organizations published in the previous year. The book has also been shortlisted by the British International Studies Association. Inken, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Inken, this is a fascinating study that has resulted in some new empirical data and a great deal of insights that challenge some of our intuitions about exit from international organizations. Can you tell me a little bit about what motivated this study and what was happening in the world when you first got underway with this work?
Sure, yeah. So we first really got interested in state exit from international organizations in 2011, which is now really 15 years ago. But we were intrigued and puzzled by a case in 2011 from the Arab League, where the Arab League suspended both Libya and Syria over government-sponsored human rights violations. And we found this puzzling because it's essentially a club of mostly autocratic states, often using some forms of political exclusion, sometimes even repression, against their own populations. And so to us, it seemed puzzling that a club like that would suspend one of their own for, yes, more egregious human rights violations, but still. And so we wanted to know if this is a typical case, if there are other cases like that, and turned to research, as academics do, but quickly figured out that research actually doesn't have to say much about suspensions, both in legal research, in international law, as well as in political science research. There wasn't a lot of studies on this. Studies have mostly focused on when states join or accede to organizations, but not when they leave. And so we started to collect data on suspensions to look at the historical record and figure out how unusual these cases really were. And while we did that, we realized that actually withdrawal, so being or voluntarily leaving in international organizations rather than being kicked out from the club, is even more common than suspensions. So there's about four times more withdrawals than there are suspensions over the last 100 plus years. And to us, that was even more puzzling because many member states expend lots of effort to join international organizations. They are usually members in these organizations for years and decades. They pay their membership dues, they participate, benefit from these organizations. So what is it that suddenly changes that makes member states step away from these organizations? And so we started collecting data both on suspensions and withdrawals. In the meantime, Brexit happened, 2016, 2020. The first Trump administration came along and withdrew from UNESCO, announced leaving the World Health Organization, et cetera. And that was also interesting to us because the common interpretation or the conventional wisdom when observers commented on these high-profile recent cases was a story about nationalism and populism, backlash against international institutions, unchaining and freeing themselves from international infringements on their sovereign rights. And while that might well explain certain aspects of Brexit and also the first Trump administration, second Trump administration, it actually didn't fit well with the larger historical record that we had uncovered in terms of cases across hundreds of international organizations, across 190 plus states, and over the last 100 years. So that book then that you see in front of yourself is both an effort to correct some misperceptions and to put forward what we think is a better explanation of state exit from an international organization, which revolves around an attempt to negotiate institutional change.
Yeah, you point to a common intuition that nationalism, populism is driving exit from international organizations. But before I dive into that, I want to talk about the really remarkable data gathering effort that this book represents. And when you are studying international organizations as a unit of study, how did you come to define it? And how did you think about the case studies? And were there cases in the gray, organizations in the gray, that didn't quite fit into the model as you were building up your database?
Sure, yeah. So we actually try to make our lives quite easy in terms of drawing on a definition of international organization that is now standard in the field. And for us, when we say international organization, really what we mean is a formal intergovernmental organization. And so that means it's a group, it's a club of at least three member states, oftentimes many more regional or global organizations, that has an independent secretariat with headquarters and staff working in these headquarters. And they have regular plenary meetings that are taking place. And there is usually, an underlying treaty or charter for these organizations. So that definition is fairly standard in the field. The data set that captures these international organizations is one by John Peavyhouse and co-authors. It's called the COW IGO dataset, Correlates of War IGO dataset. And so we essentially just take that corpus of international organizations that tracks who has been a member state in these organizations over which years. It starts in 1816 through today. And what we're doing is essentially adding information in the form of variables, tracking which of these member states at what point in time withdrew or was suspended from which organization, as well as when they returned. So we're using that corpus. What falls into that definition are global organizations like the United Nations itself, the World Health Organization, as well as regional organizations, thinking about the African Union, European Union, Organization of American States, Arab League included, but also smaller, perhaps less well-known organizations like the Universal Postal Union or IRENA. And so that's inside the clubs, inside that definition. Outside of that definition would be things like informal organizations that don't have a secretariat building with staff and headquarters, treaties and executive agreements that would not be part of that definition, or institutions that have less than three member states, when we think about bilateral agreements, for example. So those would not be things that we capture in that assembly.
And because you mention the two Trump administrations, the former and the current Trump administration, I wonder if you could tell us about the period that you cover in this work. Did you have to, when do the case studies and the research stop? And so what are we looking at in terms of the full spectrum of case studies?
Mm-hmm. So we, the data collection that we did essentially tries to cover all, so in that catalog, there's 534 international organizations, 198 states, and then it starts in 1815. We have the same scope of international organizations and of states, but the first case that we could document in terms of leaving an international organization was in 1914. And so that's when our first case of withdrawal starts, and then 1939 is when our first case of suspension starts. We go up to 2022. That's how long we collected the data that's represented in the book, just because at some point we did want to publish the book, and so you need to cut it off at some point. But we have kept collecting data on this and tracking from 2023 to 2025 and six, the recent cases, and they're very much in line so far anyways with what we've seen in the years previously.
That's really helpful. I think in the commentary around exit of international organizations, there may be a certain recency bias where we are focused on the recent cases, the cases that capture headlines. But if we look to your database and the research that you've done, what are some of the trends that emerge, and particularly some of those insights around how regular state exit is over time? Is this a unique phenomenon? Is it something that is quite contemporary, or has it happened quite regularly over the period that you've studied?
So we've seen about 500 exits from international organizations. We've seen 387 withdrawals, 101 suspensions. When you look at this over the broad time frame and across countries, it's about 3 to 4 exits per year. You can also think about this in terms of country representation, so about 2% of countries withdraw any given year. You can also think about this in terms of like IO member state year scope, and then it's 0.06%. So, like, depending on where you want to put your emphasis, it's more or less frequent. But it is a very regular, consistent appearance over time. This is not just a very recent phenomenon. It's something that we've seen over time for many years. Some of the trends that we found quite interesting in the data is this consistency. The second thing that we found is quite interesting in the data is that the data actually show exits have not increased over time. So if we listen to, you know, observers, analysts, think tanks, they're quite alarmed and concerned, as are we, about some of the recent exits from international organizations. But the perception seems to be that exits have really exploded in the last 5, 10, 15 years. And using the data that we have collected, we're able to show that that perception is actually not true. That for withdrawals, the trend has been fairly consistent over time. And especially if we put this in context, not just in terms of the absolute numbers, but in the context of the growth of international organizations and the growth of member states inside these organizations, because more and more states have joined these clubs, then actually for withdrawals, at least, we see either a constant or a slightly lower decreasing line in the last 10, 15 years. So those trends were interesting to us. The other interesting trend was that member states actually often return to international organizations. So what we found in the data is that about 50% of states that withdraw from an international organization return to the same organization later on. That usually takes a few years, sometimes more, sometimes less, but 50% of states return. And for the types of suspensions, so being kicked out from an international organization, the rate is even higher. So 80% of states that have been suspended from an international organization return later on, which again for us sort of shows that it's not the terminal walking away from international cooperation forever, but for us it's part of this renegotiation, reassessment argument, trying to negotiate change in terms of the institution.
Yeah, let's unpack that argument. It's one of the major findings of your book, that the motivation behind threats of exit and actual exit is less a reflection of national populism or a nationalist turn domestically, but more an effort to try to institute change in an international organization, try to extract some kind of institutional pivot. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that? What some states are trying to achieve, and maybe give us a few examples?
Sure, yeah. So we essentially argue that exit is oftentimes used as a strategy to try to negotiate institutional change, either at the international level or at the domestic level. At the international level here, we're talking about withdrawal. So states that use the threat of withdrawing, the announcement of withdrawing, or actually withdrawing as a tool to try to renegotiate the deals in the organization. And for suspension, we essentially say that this is oftentimes used as a tool to try to renegotiate change on the domestic level. So states that have violated underlying commitments in the charters of IOs, for example, many organizations have charter commitments to human rights, democracy, rule of law. And so when states have a coup d'etat or human rights violations, as in the case of the Arab League, they might be kicked out because they violated these things. And then the exit is essentially used as an attempt to try to punish them for that non-compliant behavior and give them incentive to actually return to the organization. So that's the argument that we make in the book in terms of an attempt to try to renegotiate institutional change either at the international or at the domestic level.
I want to explore the state and the different types of states that we're talking about, because some states are large, they have many commitments across a large number of international organizations, and so their behavior might change depending on the number of commitments that they have and what they're trying to achieve. And so do you find a trend in terms of the states that have most frequently withdrawn from international organizations? Does it correlate to the number of obligations that they have? And that's one question around the state itself. And the second is around state power. And how might that affect how they conceive of their place in an international organization and their ability to extract some kind of change from the organization in question?
Mm-hmm. So we have looked at the frequency of withdrawal from certain types of organizations as well as from certain types of states, and similarly for the suspension side. So in terms of the withdrawal, the states that have most frequently left international organizations are the UK, the US, and Canada. And that's just in terms of absolute numbers, like how often have they actually left over the last 110 years. That's one way to think about it in terms of absolute numbers. But of course, we can also, as you suggest, look at this in terms of like, well, what's their integration into the international community, right? Because if you have joined 5 international organizations versus 50 international organizations, you also have a much different pool of those that you could leave, mm-hmm. and a much different, you know, frequency means different things in that case. And so when we actually put it in context with the level of international integration, the level of international organization memberships that these countries have, then some of the insights are a little bit different. The U.S. still ranks among the top countries, but there's also others, like, for example, Indonesia or Poland, who are, you know, among the top 10 or 15 countries. So they're potentially not the kinds of countries we usually think about, but that have historically, for example, at the beginning of the Cold War or in other period times during decolonization and later on, left some of these international institutions. And just because they haven't been as internationally integrated percentage-wise, they then rank a little bit higher. And your second question?
Yeah, state power.
State power. So we look at whether state power influences withdrawal as well as suspension. In terms of withdrawal, one of the things that we find that powerful states, when they first make their threats of withdrawal, tend to be more successful in actually getting some concessions from international organizations when they express dissatisfaction with particular policies or financial contributions or programs or the status of another member state in these international organizations. Usually these are very distinct, specific grievances and dissatisfactions where the state wants to have change within that international organization. And so powerful states are oftentimes more successful in getting what they want through a threat of withdrawal before they actually have to leave. For withdrawal, interestingly, declining power states are more likely to withdraw or to actually threaten and then also withdraw later on. And we think this is because if you're declining in power relative to other states in the world, but also particularly within the international organization, you have an incentive to try to renegotiate now rather than 5 or 10 years, because you still have a little bit more leverage now than you would have in the future. And so there's an incentive to try to sort of start that process now. For suspension, one thing that we find is that if you have more power, you might be able to insulate yourselves from the pressures of potentially being kicked out by a club. So one of the things that we find is that if a state has more power in terms of having close allies or friends in the organization, regional hegemons being closely aligned with those, or having strong economic power, so think about GDP, GDP per capita, but also resources, that oftentimes they can potentially leverage those resources to try to avoid bargain pay side payments to other states in order to not be punished, even though maybe they have backslid just like another country in the organization before.
You mentioned threats, and this is a big part of the book. How should we think about threats and the credibility of threats? Are they common? Is there typically follow through on a threat with a withdrawal? What does the evidence suggest?
Yes. So I will caveat my response by saying that we think really good data on exit from international organizations. The data on threats is much harder to collect. So we've certainly done our best, but there's, I think, so many threats that we've heard about when we did field work or that we read about when we actually went into the archives of international organizations that are mentioned in these minutes or that are mentioned oftentimes even behind closed doors that you see exchanges or mentions of that aren't even officially documented. And so the way we have captured threats so far is through mostly news media announcements, so what you see in the newspapers as well as IO documentation and archives. But we think while our data on exit cases is very good and quite complete, we are not so sure about the threat. So just with that caveat in mind, what we show in the book is that a low percentage of threats is actually be followed through. So just about 10 or 15% of cases actually of threats actually manifest in real exit cases. So there's way more threats, way more announcement, much more rhetoric around potentially leaving than is actually panned out when post comes to stuff. And that might be because, you know, some of these threats are later rescinded because the member state finds out that perhaps they have overplayed their hand or they've changed their mind or a new government comes into power Or it might be because actually they were successful in trying to negotiate some of those concessions and some of those changes, and so they don't actually need to leave. Similarly, on the side of the suspension, there is not a lot of good record that we could find in terms of documenting all the threats of suspension, but there is a couple of organizations that we have included in the book that actually have some documentation of where they give countries the yellow card before the countries receive the red card. And so here, too, we could sort of document that there's more threats of suspension than there actually are suspensions mm-hmm. later on.
This is a common occurrence. It's an important theme of the book that this is not just a contemporary phenomenon, but that this has been happening over time, both exits and the threat of exit. One might be forgiven for thinking that the exit of a powerful state or multiple exits in a particular period of time might create a kind of contagion effect, that others will find this kind of behavior more permissible and will then follow suit. Do you see any evidence of that when you track the number of exits or threats of exit over time, and maybe speak about any spikes in that historical analysis? But do you see any evidence of this leading to or prompting other states to follow suit?
Mm-hmm. So yes and no, I think. So we have an earlier article before the book in 2019 where we actually talk in quite some detail about contagion, as you call it, right? So in here, what we show is that if a powerful state leaves the international organization, then yes, sometimes other states follow through. One example is in the 2010s, the UK left UNIDO, the UN Industrial Development Organization, and then several other states followed through. I think 5, 6, 7 different states followed through in the rest of the 2010s. Now, what's sometimes hard to assess is whether that contagion or that clustering is because one of the big states left and then others take their lead from that one state and they leave as well, or if there's something actually quite shared about dissatisfaction that is currently going wrong in the organization where several states are disagreeing with, and so they leave around the same time in a small smattering. So contagion does happen, but we actually find that that is quite limited to just certain events. So I gave you the example of the UK. There's another example when a country has financial or economic hardships that they might review their membership in international organizations because they're paying financial contributions to each of these organizations every year. And so when Canada, for example, has an austerity budget in the 2010s, they withdrew from 3 or 4 organizations in that time period. So that might be something that's happening. The other classes that we've seen are around certain times of geopolitical upheaval. So when you look at the distribution of exits over time, there's a cluster or a peak just before World War II, where several Axis powers and some Latin American states leave the League of Nations as well as the International Labor Organization. Then you have another cluster in the early 50s and a little bit in the 60s where mostly Eastern European states have essentially left international global organizations because as they were forming into two separate blocks with the Soviet Union versus the Western states, they then created regional organizations and wanted to move away from some of these global organizations like the Food and Agriculture Organization, etc. And so we see those kinds of patterns. But apart from those spikes, the usual average case is really sort of a one-off. Like a state has a disagreement, dissatisfaction as a preference outlier with certain policies, programs, leadership decisions in a specific organization. So while these clusters exist, any one normal average year where there's 3 to 4 states that are leaving is very much like a one-off occurrence rather than a large smattering of states leaving at the same time.
Given how common this occurrence is, again, and how regular it is, it would be interesting to know if there's a price, if you've been able to identify a particular price that states pay either for threatening to exit or actually exiting, perhaps in terms of their credibility, willingness of others to do business with them, in terms of their readmittance also possibly.
So, we have tried to trace this. So in terms of the credibility or the cost you pay for a threat of exit, we would say that even states that are in a position to make those threats, they can't necessarily make them any other day against any other organization. Because if you make these threats too often, you will lose the credibility of that thing, because most of the time then these states are not actually following through, right? So there's a literature in international relations that also talks about audience costs. So the idea that leaders sometimes get, have repercussions or are getting, negative consequences on the domestic level if they are not actually honoring their previous announcements. And so this is a sort of similar way of thinking about threats. Like, if you make them, they better be credible. Otherwise, it's cheap talk and it might not be valued in the future. It might not be taken seriously. In terms of costs of actually exiting, the way we've thought about this in the book is in terms of two costs, or three costs, actually. Reputational costs, cooperative costs, and then also material costs. So for both suspension and withdrawal, we're documenting the reputational costs, essentially what other states in the international community or what private actors in the international community think about you as a reliable partner, and then also the cooperative costs. So whether they actually engage in future international agreements with you once you have left these international organizations. And for both withdrawal and suspension, what we document is that there is a dip in reputation for 2, 3, 4 years, both in terms of reputation by private market actors and reputation in terms of other states in the international community, and that states in the next few years after withdrawing from an international organization are usually less likely to engage in future cooperation with you. So this follows on work by Avery Schmidt, who has also done a very nice article on when states leave international treaties. And so here we're essentially doing something very similar for international organization, which is a subset showing very similar cooperative costs in the future in terms of reduction in future agreements where the countries are less likely to ratify new treaties with you.
So if a state exits an international organization because they've sought a particular policy change and that hasn't materialized, might they go and forum shop? Might they try to create a parallel organization or join a smaller club of states that may be more amenable to their particular position? Is that something that you find in the data?
They could, in principle. We haven't pursued that sort of as a systematic research question, but it has come up in some of the cases. So one of the things you might be thinking about is when recently three states were suspended from ECOWAS for military coups. And so these states, once they've been suspended from ECOWAS, actually decided to then withdraw from ECOWAS, which is sort of a face-saving diplomatic move. And then meanwhile, also set up a new organization, the Alliance of Sahel States. And so that's a security organization now where ECOWAS was mostly economic, but also security related. And so you can make some inference about that of potentially parallel organizations. But we would think that for the most part, because international organizations are quite costly to create, set up, organize, and actually lift off the ground, creating alternative institutions is fairly rare thing, right? One case that we might be thinking about is currently China in terms of Asian Development Bank and others, where they've created new institutions, but at the same time, they actually stayed in other regional and global organizations. It's not like the either-or approach, at least for the current time being. And so from the cases at least that we've come across, we don't see a strong trend in that direction.
Exit, I think, is quite clear, is a disruptive practice, mm-hmm. and it forces a reorganization of priorities, alliances, partnerships, potentially. It's perhaps something that we want to avoid. What strategies can you think of that international organizations, their secretariats, leaders can put in place to try to prevent exit?
So there might be several things, right? So many organizations have what's called withdrawal clauses or suspension clauses. Not all international organizations have them, but some. And so when they are clearly written down, they give a lot of transparency and clarity about the process, the timeline, the ways in which states either can withdraw from the international organization, for example, in terms of the waiting period that must be abided by, if it's a few months, if it's a year, if it's 5 years, if the financial arrears that might have accumulated until then need to be paid back before the member state can actually leave. Similarly, for suspension, there's rules, there's suspension clauses, and there's voting rules that need to be followed, right, in terms of is the decision to suspend a member state reached by simple majority, supermajority, consensus minus the violator state. And so these rules are quite important. As I said, not all organizations have them. So even in the cases where an organization does not have a withdrawal clause or does not have a suspension clause, states have left the international organizations. And so sometimes that perhaps can lead to more uncertainty, more unclarity, even more friction about what is going on. So one thing to do is potentially really outline these withdrawal and suspension regularities. Of course, even when you do that, you can't foresee every single case that's coming along. And even if something that is quite detailed and well outlined, for example, with the case of Brexit from the European Union, there are still lots of questions that need to be resolved, even though there was a clear article on this that resulted in, you know, 4 years of renegotiation and drama about how that divorce will actually occur. And so thinking about withdrawal processes and suspension processes and the legal rules is one thing. The other thing I think we would say is that having regular discussions and conversations about changes in the international organization can help. So instead of responding to an ad hoc by one state that is trying to leave the international organization, where the state clearly has a grievance with the international organization and might portray that as reform, positive change, you know, addressing something that really is a dissatisfaction, other member states in the organization may or may not agree with that being framed as a positive change. And so trying to perhaps engage those kinds of states more, trying to have regular interactions and discussions on broadly governance in the organization and reform in the organization might be something that is to the benefit. And from what we've seen from the interviews with staff and also from our field work, several organizations already engage in that quite actively, but not everybody seems to be doing that. So that might be one thing to really try to buffer against changes in preferences over time, because as states change and their power and preferences, as international organizations change and more states are joining, at the world around them changes as well, right? There are going to be dissatisfactions. Mm. There are going to be disagreements. And so trying to buffer against those sudden changes that are often quite dramatic and quite ad hoc, leading to crisis in international organizations, might be a good idea.
This has been a really interesting set of insights. And it strikes me that this work actually contains a message of hope. And I'm not sure if you would agree with that. It sounds like first, while threats are made, there often isn't follow through. Even when there is follow through, there's quite frequently return to the international organization, both in terms of a voluntary withdrawal, but also in cases of suspension, even more in the case of suspension. And so it tells me that actually this is both a vibrant space, one where states decide to continue to invest in internationalism, in multilateralism, and that it's these contemporary cases perhaps that we see where we come away with the impression that this is a disintegrating multilateral system may be too severe a conclusion. And I'm not sure if you would agree with that this work is actually a message of positivity and hope if you take it in the historical context, or do you have a different view?
I think it can be. I support your interpretation of positivity and hope. I think it's always good to have a silver lining. Yes, I mean, what we show is that, yes, not all threats, actually only a small share of threats goes through. The leaving might not be permanent, it might be temporary, there might be positive change, and sometimes even a reinvigoration of the international organization, right? So, for example, in the World Health Organization recently, there seemed to be sort of a gridlock in terms of getting the new pandemic treaty on the ground. And then after 2024, the US withdrew from the international organization. And now we have a pandemic treaty that is perhaps more broad in scope and more legally binding than could have been achieved if the US had still been at the table. And so there are moments where remaining member states and the secretariat staff can try to look at these as opportunities for renovation, revitalization, reform. But it really depends on the efforts and the willingness of the remaining member states as well as the secretariat, and also can depend on if the state that has left the organization might return to the organization, and if so, when, right? So there are certainly aspects of hope that you can take from that. But we would also underline that even if the state later on returns, of course, the organization has lost a member state. So the scope, the geographic scope of whatever they're doing is going to be more limited than it was previously. Similarly, in the case of suspension, right, you're essentially losing one of the states at your table. And whenever a state leaves, it sort of could be damaging to the legitimacy of the organization. It is certainly damaging in terms of the member state contributions, be they financial, be they operational, be they practical, be they playing a security role in a given area, be they a large market share of that given commodity organization. So there's clear costs involved, not just for the member state, but also for the international organization. And so I think I would just temper the optimism just a slight bit.
Great. This work has considerable momentum. And I wonder if you could speak to the audience and tell them where you think this research might go in future. What are some of the questions that you're now seized with?
So we're really pleased we have finished this book. Our new project, let me take it two ways. So there's a lot of questions that this book raises in the conclusion for future research. So while we have provided this empirical data set that we hope will put others in a position to actually look at their favorite cases and put things in context, there's a lot of questions that we could not incorporate into the book. So for example, we looked at the effects on states, but we haven't analyzed in this book the effect of on international organizations. We have an article on what withdrawal means for the survival or death of international organizations. We have an article on threats and what it does to negotiation in the organization. But there's a lot of scope for thinking about how that influences international organization legitimacy, international organization performance, effectiveness, programming, et cetera. Right? So several colleagues are now working in those directions, but I think that's where research is still very much open-ended. For us, the next step will actually be to look into sort of participation of states. A frequent comment that we received when we were doing this research was, yes, exit is very important. We should know more about this. We're glad you're doing this work. But there's so many things that states do before they actually leave international organizations. They might withhold their funding or delay their funding. They might try to obstruct or veto or block certain policy decisions. They might try to slow pedal things. They might downgrade the level of representation at the international organization or interfere with summit meetings. And so those kinds of lowering participation will be our next step forward in this research agenda. And our first cut at the moment is looking at funding of international organizations, so sort of the monetary side as a way to potentially negotiate and obstruct international organizations. But certainly this opens up a rich research agenda that we hope many other researchers as well as policymakers will actually take forward.
And the reaction from the audience today to your presentation was suggested that there is going to be a lot of interest in this research, a lot of appetite for the findings. And we're so grateful to you for having spent the time with us here in New York to talk about your findings, talk about this work and the future research directions. Inken, congratulations to you, to Felicity on this important publication. And we wish you the best of luck on your research.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.